Coming up on episode 243 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Honda Civic Si, the BMW i4, Ford hooks up with Alexa, BMW's X7 gets a refresh, Genesis reveals the X Speedium Coupe, Radwood hits the New York Auto Show, all that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 243 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abuel Sandwich from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from The Verge.
That's a cool name that they have. Unfortunately, Nicole is with her mom in the hospital again today. Hopefully, her mom is going to be all right. And I also have an interview coming up later on with Larry Dominique, head of Alfa Romeo in North America, talking a bit about what Alfa is doing. They recently announced that they're going to be going all electric as a brand by 2027, and they want to they've got some big growth plans, which hopefully, unlike the previous big growth plans they had under the late CEO Sergio Marchionne, may actually come to fruition this time. So all that will be coming up later in the show. But for now, what have you been driving, Roberto?
So I have been driving the BMW i4. I drove this vehicle in Germany? Yeah, either earlier this year or late last year. Time makes no sense anymore. Anyway, I drove the car in Germany, and I was extremely impressed because, you know, BMW had the i3, they had the i8, and then they just kept talking about this modular factory where they could throw any, you know, powertrain they wanted into a vehicle. You could throw it into, you know, you could put it an EV into an i4, you put a hybrid into a 4 series, you could throw a, you know, a gas engine, this whole thing. And it just felt like forever before anything was actually out. And then finally the i4 and the iX came out, and all that time was time well spent, because these cars drive so great. I was so impressed with what they had done with the vehicle in order to make it feel like a proper 4-series sedan that just happens to be an EV. It does have that heft of a battery. I mean, you can't fight with physics. I mean, you can fight with physics all you want, but physics always wins at some point. You just have to make a deal with physics. That's essentially what car makers are doing. They're just making a deal. They're
trying to compromise.
Let's be friends.
Yeah, trying to get a reasonable compromise.
Get a reasonable compromise. The i4, the interior feels like a 4-series. The iX, on the other hand, it feels very spacious. They have little crystal-like bits. They have a crystal shifter. They got all this stuff. It makes it feel a little bit more futuristic. Meanwhile, the i4, which is, the best-selling sedan that BMW has, you sit in that, and unless someone told you that it was an electric vehicle, before it started and you didn't hear the engine, you'd have to be told. So it's very nice. It's very on brand for BMW. I did a range test with it. You know, I do my 100 miles around Northern California, and it did really well, because it's not this high, you know, it's not all, you know, they didn't sit there and carve everything off of it to make it more aerodynamic the way Mercedes has with the EQS versus the S series. They're just like, here's a 4-series with a different grill. Well, different grill, a large grill, but with different things inside, some different badging and I don't know, some other stuff. This one is rated, this was the, my mouse froze. Oh no. There it goes. Sorry about that. This one is the one I drove was the i4 eDrive 40. Now it comes with 18 or 19 inch wheels. I drove the 19 inch wheel version. It's rear wheel drive. It has an EPA range of 282 miles, which is, that's pretty good. During my drive, it did 300 miles, according to my calculations. So better. You get an extra 18 miles. And this, you know, again, 50% of the drive is driving at 70 miles an hour with the cruise control on a highway. And then the rest of it is back roads and mostly suburban driving, just sort of driving around town. Some of this, you know, involves going up to 50, 60 miles an hour in some of these where the houses are sort of separate from the mm-hmm. road, you know, to get the suburbanites to the Starbucks as quickly as possible. Yeah, I was really, really impressed with how well this vehicle did. It has an 83.9 kilowatt hour capacity battery pack. Of that, 81.5 kilowatt hours is available to the vehicle at any one time. The car told me it was doing 3.7 miles per kilowatt hour, which is...
I mean, that's the same as what I got from the Mini a couple of weeks ago. And that's a lot smaller car.
Which is really, really good for a car that size. Again, that hasn't been really modified mm-hmm. to make it any more aerodynamic than the regular vehicle. So kudos to the engineers over there at BMW and whatever they have been doing over the past few years to make this vehicle a reality and make it sort of a no compromise 4 Series that happens to be an EV. It's pretty great. The one I had was the MSRP was $55,400. Then you know it's some paint. Some dynamic handling, which was $1,700. The driver's assistance package, which is $1,700, which includes their extended traffic jam assistant, which it is their hands-off system up to 40 miles an hour on the highway. So if you're stuck on the highway, you're doing under 40 miles an hour, you're stuck in stop-and-go traffic, you hit the little button on the steering wheel, and boop. Little green lights show up on the wheel itself, and then you can do hands free. But you do have to pay attention to the road. Anytime I looked away, obviously it got very, very angry with me. I think the most expensive thing on their list was the $2,400 M Sport package, which you're not getting an M car, you're getting an M package, and it
makes it look more like an M car.
It makes it look more like an M car. All set out the door, $68,270 with a $995 destination charge, which is now on the low side.
Yeah.
That's where we are, where BMW's destination charge is on the low side. And this car was built in Munich, in Germany. This car is built in Germany. Had to come over from Germany. It would cost you more to buy a flight probably from Germany right now than the destination charge on this vehicle. Overall, I really liked it. I'm going to have a full write-up on The Verge. When you do a first drive with the vehicle, you don't get to sort of live with it. You know, you drive it for the day.
You don't really experience most of the quirks.
Yeah, you know, because they have us like, this is the road we've already picked for you, and this is the, you know, this is what you're going to be doing throughout the day, and you don't get to charge it because, you know, we're going to charge it for you, or it'll be fully charged. It's a very well handled experience. This, on the other hand, when you have it for a week, then you really sort of like see all the little issues that might pop up, or all the little like nice things that might pop up. I really like this vehicle. Good job, BMW.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioned the word no compromise, or the phrase no compromise. And earlier this week, I was at a BMW event in New York, I heard their CEO Oliver Zipse repeat that phrase many, many times in the course of a couple of hours. You know, no compromise, no compromise. He was referring to another car, which we can't talk about until next week. I think what's interesting, you know, BMW's approach to EVs, you know, they started off, you know, they did the i3, which was as purpose-built an EV as you might possibly imagine. You know,
it's a concept car that they're just like, you know what, let's just make this.
Yeah. it was originally conceived, you know, as part of what they, you know, in the what they originally came up with in about 2007 or 2008 as their megacity project. You know, they were looking at it from the perspective of, you know, as we have the growth of these megacities, you know, these are cities with populations of over 10 million people around the world. How do we provide transportation in those kinds of cities? How does the vehicle have to evolve for that? And what came out of that project was the i3. I always thought the i3 was a really cool urban city car. You know, it had a carbon fiber structure. It was the lowest. It was the first sort of semi-mainstream vehicle ever with a carbon fiber structure. It truly was, I think, in many ways, to the degree that anything can ever be no compromises. And I've written a blog post for Guidehouse Insights, my employer, the other day about this idea of no compromises. And the reality is that there is actually no such thing as a no compromises car.
It's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, even a $3 million Bugatti Chiron has compromises. You know, you can't drive it at its maximum speed without going through a whole rigmarole of different things to get it prepared. And you have to use special tires, and you can only drive it at that speed for a short period of time before it completely depletes the fuel in the tank. So it has compromises. Yeah. The i3 had compromises. It was fairly small, so it was not for huge families. It's great for cities. You know, engineering is always about balancing compromises. And I think what's interesting is BMW's strategy, unlike some of their competitors who are planning to go 100% electric, at least in Europe and maybe in China by 2030, and somewhat less in North America and other markets. You know, their stated target is to be 50% electric globally by 2030. I don't think they've actually given a specific number for Europe. It'll probably be significantly more than 50%, but 50% globally, which means that half of their vehicles are still going to have some form of internal combustion, almost all hybridized to some degree or another. And because of that, they're what I think would be classed as a medium-sized automaker. They do about 2.5 million cars a year. So they're a lot smaller than a Volkswagen or Toyota that does 10 million cars a year. And for them to justify the development of all-electric architectures is going to be more challenging. They don't have as much scale as some of their competitors do. They are developing an all-electric platform for 2025 that has been called the Neue Klasse, the new class. But it's it's going to be several years before we see that. In the meantime, everything they're now that they've discontinued the i3, they're using flexible architectures that allow them to go gas or diesel or plug-in hybrid or battery electric, like the i4 and like other stuff that's coming up. And that, I think, is more inherently compromised. For example, the i4, it has those somewhat classic BMW proportions, performance car proportions, long hood, cabin kind of set back a little bit, that when you look at it in profile, it's fairly typical of a BMW or other premium performance oriented vehicles. And there's another one, this other vehicle that's going to be announced next week, same thing. But despite having all that space in front of the firewall, there's no front storage. There's no front trunk, not even a little storage compartment to hold a charging cable. You'd have to put the charging cable in the back if you take it with you. What do you think about and another one, because it's still using the same common structure with the gas engine models, it still has a center tunnel where the drive shaft would go through, even though there's no drive shaft going to the back. So you lose second rear seat legroom in the middle.
Well, first of all, no adult should sit in the middle of the back seat. that's just thing that doesn't.
For the i4, that's a reasonable argument, but yeah, it's not necessarily the case for all models.
Also, the frunk, to be honest, unless the frunk is huge, I don't care. Whenever someone shows me a frunk that'll fit like a briefcase, I'm like, who? So,
Yeah.
I just don't care. It's just that's
no, I agree.
That's likely never ever going to be used. You know, I think at the end of the day, what people want is a car that drives like the car that they were in before, or feels better than that car. And I think that's the EV thing, is that the cars drive better for the most part than the vehicle, the other vehicle in the same class, the gas vehicle. And so I think that's what BMW is doing right now, is trying to make a vehicle that drives as good as or better than the same variant in the gas vehicle. And, you know, they have Mini, who's going all electric, which is cool. But, they were kind of, I feel like they're almost like GM, where GM was out pretty early with the Bolt, and before that, the EV1. And then they're like, oh, we have Ultium. And then we just waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. And meanwhile, you know, and I always bring up Hyundai, but Hyundai was just like, oh, here's a bunch of cars that we just keep making some EVs. And I think, you know, BMW, they couldn't just come back out with this modular architecture and have like an okay EV. It had to be good. And, you know, the center console, or the tunnel, you're like, well, you know, the tunnel. I think most people probably won't even cross their minds when they're getting it. Yeah, they're going to lose some of that weird that storage that people have been putting underneath where the tunnel would be. And of course, the lack of a frunk is, again, to me, unless the frunk is huge, unless we're talking, you know, a nice large frunk, I kind of don't care. I've gotten, well, if I get a car and the frunk is like, I don't even mention it anymore in reviews, because it's like mentioning like an extra little cubby hole in the car. And I'm just like, well, okay, well, fine. But except now it's really hard to get to. It's not something you're going to think about. I guess you could put your wallet in there so people won't. I mean, people can still get to it. That's the other thing. Someone was trying to make the argument with me that, you can put things, it's more secure. I'm like, not really, because thieves break into your car and they pop open, you know, the back, and they pop open the front. I've had parts stolen off of a car because they broke into the car and opened the hood and stole parts off of it because that's what they wanted. They didn't care what was in the trunk. So it's, you know, as more and more thieves are like, oh, well, there's going to be a stuff up front. They're going to be looking for stuff up front. So it's even the security sort of thing isn't. I mean, the most secure thing in your car right now is that locking glove box. You know, glove box where you still use a key.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most secure area of your car right now.
Although that's not very hard to open with a big screwdriver.
No, it's not very. But it's like it's the idea of security. Like the least, you know, they want to get in and out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
It's like if your house is locked and your neighbor's house isn't locked, like which one are they going to go after?
Right. And you know, that's a valid argument, you know, that I think in most cases people aren't going to use the frunk. You know, in most cases it's too small to be useful. But on the other hand, you know, the flip side of that is, okay, if you're not going to have a frunk there and you don't have an engine, you know, you can reconfigure the way the whole car is packaged, and you can shorten up that whole front end. You don't need that giant long hood like you have on the iX and the i4. Look at what VW has done with the ID4 and the ID3. You know, if you look at them in profile, they've moved the base of the windshield forward, moved the bulkhead forward, and they've shortened up that whole front end of the car, because they don't have a frunk, but they're also not having to accommodate an engine in there. And so
you're asking BMW to make a compromise on design, to change the design. And I think we've all learned that BMW doesn't care.
Oh, well, that's a – yeah, actually, okay. You win on that one.
We have that big thing that, like, people are like, oh, I don't know about that. And they're like, no, we're just going to keep doing it until you like it. That's essentially – now, like, I look at the i4 now, I'm like, it's not so bad. If I that's what they've done.
It's you've
like,
just given up hope.
Yeah, you've just – like the Prius. The Prius was never a pretty car. But at some point, you're just like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's that. Like, we're just going to keep putting it out, and you're going to like it whether you like it. Eventually, you're going to like it, or at least you're going to grow to accept it. I think that's what BMW has done. And I think for them, they're like, we still want to have the cars that look like the cars.
Right.
And like you said, you know, it's a lot of money to have a dedicated architecture. And I do kind of wish they had gone dedicated before modular, but you know, I think they were trying to be as cautious as possible.
Yeah, and you know, it. I mean, they did it before, and it wasn't a huge market success with the i3,
which is disappointing because the i3 is awesome.
Yeah. And
so many people hate that car. Like, they either love it or hate it.
And most of the people that hate it have never driven it.
Yeah, they've never driven it. It's a fun little car. It's like a little living room. It's just this fun little city car. You can park it anywhere. Should you do a cross-country drive in it? Probably not.
Not unless you want it to be a very leisurely drive where you have to stop every 100 miles.
Yeah. But, you know, just cruising around town, especially in an urban or even a suburban area, I think, you know, it's a fun little thing. You know, you can park it anywhere you want. It's got a sweet little turning circle. It's got just enough room for, you know, your stuff. You and your friend want to go for a little cruise around. It's great.
Yeah. No, I love the i3. I'll be getting the i4s and the Michigan press fleet pretty soon, and I'll get a chance to try one for myself. At least I think they're planning to have one at the Mama Spring Rally at Road America next month. So,
cool.
I'll at least get to drive one there.
I expected to get in it and feel like they had it wasn't going to be as good just because it is the modular, and it's like, mm-hmm. Wait, you're just throwing this into this, and like the e-Golf, except, you know, a bit more purpose built. It's really good.
All right.
Speaking of which, I missed the e-Golf. Bring the e-Golf back.
Yeah, me too. All right. I had the Honda Civic Si in blazing orange pearl. So this is the 200 horsepower version of the new Civic sedan. There's no coupe this generation. You know, we've talked before about the design of the 2022 Civic, which, you know, is a little more tame than before. It's a little less interesting to look at. It looks very much like a 7/8 scale version of the current generation Accord. It's not bad. It's just not as interesting as before.
It's just sort of, I feel like they've gone backwards a bit when it comes to the design. I like the sort of stabby design.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, it was a little much on the Type R, but that's also, I mean, the Type R is a little much, period. So
yeah. The Civic Si comes with the 1.5 liter 4-cylinder turbo that's also in more pedestrian Civics, but with an extra 20-25 horsepower and a 6-speed manual transmission, and a wonderful 6-speed it is. You know, aside from the exterior design being tamed down a little bit, and the blazing orange pearl paint, which is an extra $395, really helps to offset some of that. Because
it's so pretty. It's worth the $400.
Absolutely. You know, if you're going to buy one of these, spring for the extra $400 and get the orange. It's a fantastic color. The blue is also very good. The Aegean blue. I'm really a big fan of that one as well. But the blazing orange pearl is awesome. The version that I had, the SI sedan, comes in two variants. You can get it with all season tires, starting at $27,300, or for an extra $200, you can get it with summer tires, for a little bit of extra grip, which, unfortunately it was kind of cold most of the time I had it. So I didn't want to really push it too hard, but, it was definitely, it was excellent. Driving this car is amazing. The engine has just enough power to be a lot of fun. It's responsive. The 6-speed manual is great. The interior, while I thought the exterior was a little bit of a step back, the interior is definitely a step forward from the previous generation. And the seats that they put in the SI are amazing. Last week I was talking about the Mini Cooper. And the fact that, you know, the side bolsters on the lower cushion were a little bit too narrow and pressing in on my thighs a bit too much. The seats in the Civic Si don't have a lot of adjustments, basically fore aft height and recline for the seat back, and that's it. But it getting in and sitting in this thing, it felt like, you know, with race cars, you know, they with high-end race cars, you know, for the drivers, they actually get the drivers in there and they actually make a custom seat for each driver and mold it to their body. That's what the seat in the SI, Civic Si felt like to me. It felt like, yes, they measured my body and made a seat to fit me. I don't know how well it fits anybody else, but it worked great for me. It was extremely comfortable, very supportive, in all the right places. It was near perfect, in that respect. The SI also comes with power moonroof, Bose premium sound system, auto climate control, leather wrapped steering wheel, and all Civics this year get the Honda Sensing package as standard equipment, which compared to the previous generation Civic, like the styling, is both taking a step forward and a step back. On the step forward side, they finally ditched the silly lane watch system that had a camera under the passenger mirror that when you put on the right turn signal would display the view from that camera, which is basically looking down the right-hand side of the car to make sure you weren't clipping the curb.
But only one side of the car.
But yeah, only on one side of the car. but they had no, you know, proper blind spot monitoring system, you know, radar-based blind spot monitoring system. The new Civic has... gets rid of lane watch, gets the rear corner radars for the blind spot monitoring, much better. Cross traffic alert when you're backing out of parking spaces, very handy to have. The downside is that while you gain two radar sensors in the rear corners, you lose the front radar sensor for the adaptive cruise control. And they've switched to a system that is only using the monovision camera. So only the front camera above the mirror is now used for lane keeping assist and adaptive cruise control and forward collision alert and automatic emergency braking. I didn't spend a whole lot of time driving it in the dark. For the most part, in daylight hours, the adaptive cruise control actually works better than I expected to in terms of maintaining distance to the car ahead and, you know, maintaining a reasonable distance. It seemed like it was maintaining a little bit longer gap than it would previously with the radar-based system that we have in our 2017 Civic. The biggest issue I actually had with it, though, was if you have the lane-keeping assist turned on, you can turn the lane-keeping assist on separately from the adaptive cruise control. So if you have the lane keeping assist on, despite the fact that it's, you know, basically the same as what was there before, you know, using that front camera, looking for the lanes and where you are in the lane, it seems to have a very high tendency towards false positives for detecting, you know, for thinking that you are not holding onto the steering wheel because it's using a torque sensor in the steering wheel. For hands-on. So it's, you know, it's very much a hands-on system. It's not a hands-free system. And it only seems to do this when the lane-keeping assist is on. If you turn off lane-keeping assist and just use the adaptive cruise control, it's fine. It doesn't seem to care, you know, if you're holding the wheel very steady or, you know, if you're apparently not holding the wheel at all. But if you're using the if you have the lane-keep assist turned on, then it's monitoring the motion of the steering wheel to try to detect that your hands are on the wheel because it wants to make sure that you're keeping your hands on the wheel. And like I've experienced previously with Ford and Lincoln vehicles with their Blue Cruise that use a similar system for hands-on detection, it has a lot of false positives. It's very regularly warning me to put my hands on the wheel when my hands were, in fact, on the wheel.
And you're having to wiggle your hands a little bit so the car doesn't yell at you, well, even though your hands have been on the wheel the entire time.
The problem with this system, though, is after about four or five instances of alerting you to put your hands on the wheel, if it continues to detect that, then it disables not only the lane keeping assist, but also the adaptive cruise control. So, and there's no way to get just regular cruise control. So, you know, if you're doing a highway drive and it thinks that your hands are off the wheel, it will turn off, it will disable the adaptive cruise control until you cycle the ignition.
So on long drives, if for some reason you just aren't fighting with the wheel every, 20 yeah. minutes, you just turn off the lane keeping assist.
Just don't even use it.
Turn off lane keeping assist.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Which is what I ended up doing. I just turned it off and said, forget it. I'm tired of these false alerts that my hands aren't on the wheel.
On one hand, you have the people who are like, you know what? Radar's kind of expensive. How about we just kill that and just use one camera? That'll save us some money. On the other hand, you have the lawyers who are like, hey, if you're going to do that in order to reduce our liability, we're going to make it so if you're using lane keeping assist with this one camera, we're going to make it so you have to really just be wiggling your hands the entire time.
I would rather that they spend the extra $30 or $40 on a radar sensor, and that's all it costs. I mean, modern radar sensors are not very expensive. It's like less than $40 a piece. Just put the radar sensor in there.
Yeah. Just throw the radar sensor in, charge an extra $500 for the car.
Or if you want to try to detect hands on the wheel, put capacitive sensors in the steering wheel. Don't try to use the torque sensor to detect hands on the wheel because it's a terrible way to do it. It's very unreliable and very annoying.
And it requires people to like just wiggle the wheel, which is something you don't do in real life. You're not just wiggling the wheel in your car. Yeah.
Well, the presumption is that you're going to have some motion on the wheel. Your hands are rarely going to be completely steady. But if you are actually somebody that holds the wheel very steady, on a long straight highway drive, then you're going to get false positives. It's dumb. And as I've said before, this is not a problem unique to Honda, although the particular issue of them disabling the cruise control when it detects too many hands-off-the-wheel incidents or apparent hands-off-the-wheel incidents then makes the problem worse. So just stop. Or just turn off the lane-keeping assist if you get a new Civic, and just don't even use it because it's not worth it.
But the flip side is they have like one of the best manual transmissions.
They do.
So which kind of offsets all of that. I really want Honda to be, I really want the Honda E here, by the way. But a Honda Civic, SI, that's an electric vehicle, would be outstanding. But also, I really don't want that manual transmission to ever go away. I don't know how they, the Honda makes such a great transmission. And I'm really going to be sad when it finally goes away. But kudos to them for continuing to offer it, though. So, high fives to everyone at Honda for that.
Absolutely. It's aside from that annoyance with the lane keeping, this is a fantastic car.
If you do like long drives in your car pretty often, that's going to get really annoying.
Yeah. It's got a decent sized trunk. I still prefer the hatchback, having the big opening in the back, because it's great for putting big stuff in the back. The interior on this one is really nice. Feels definitely more premium than the previous generation. Android Auto and Apple CarPlay support is very good. What else? Oh, and it was also surprisingly fuel efficient. It's rated at 27 city, 37 highway, 31 combined. I was actually averaging about 35 combined with it. So I was very impressed with that. Very, very pleased with that. Other than that, it's a great car. Including the $1,015 delivery charge, grand total came out to $28,710. The only option on here above the 27.3 for the version with the high performance tires was the $395 paint. Everything else was included as standard. So Civic Si, great choice.
That's pretty great when you just have this is the base model and it has a lot of cool stuff. It's the Si, which is the base for the Si, but you don't have to keep optioning it to get all the cool stuff that they have that's available. So plus 6-speed manual transmission.
Yeah. Oh, and the The Apple CarPlay and Android Auto support is also wireless, so you don't have to plug in via USB. And there is a wireless charging pad in there, so you can just drop your phone on there or leave your phone in your pocket or purse, and it will automatically connect when you get in the car. So that's also a good thing. There's also one of the things that they've got in here is rev matching for downshifts. You can still, do heel and toe and blip the throttle yourself. But if you choose to be a little bit lazy, and you just use the clutch, it will make sure that the revs are perfectly matched.
Can you turn it off into
gear? I don't think so. I didn't see it in there.
I like the idea of a mom or a grandmother just cruising around town and just rev matching as they're going to the store because they've had a Honda Civic since the 70s and they really love it. And they're like, they've always driven a manual and now they're doing rev matching.
Yeah. So that's the 2022 Honda Civic SI HPT sedan, HPT for high performance tires. All right. A few news items from this week. We have Ford announced a partnership with Amazon, an expanded partnership with Amazon to embed Alexa voice services in Sync 4. And Ford was one of the first automakers to have support for Alexa in their vehicles, but originally it was implemented using Sync App Link. So you had to have the Alexa app on your phone and then have your phone paired to the car. And then it would do that. So you could use your Alexa voice commands from your car through your phone.
I've done it a couple times. It's a kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's a pretty clumsy system. But since then, other automakers have actually fully embedded Alexa voice services in their vehicles, including Stellantis and GM, and I think a few others. And now Ford is doing the same thing. And I got a demo of it when we were in New York. One of the nice things is, because it's embedded right in there, you can actually use multiple voice assistants in your car, side by side. So in the case of the Ford implementation, you can say, okay, Ford, or okay, Lincoln, for some of the embedded Lincoln and Ford commands. Or you can say Alexa. If you happen to be using, have your iPhone or your Android phone paired up, you can do Siri or, Hey Google. And you can, all of these coexist side by side and you can, depending on what it is you want to do, you use one or the other. The Alexa stuff is actually integrated with some of the vehicle controls like climate control, volume, assorted other stuff, and they will be adding more functionality to that over time. So if you want to turn up the temperature and the climate control, you can say, "Hey Alexa, I'm cold," or set the temperature to 75, or 60, whatever you want. The system works pretty good. The interesting thing, when I was sitting in the demo in the car in a Lincoln Navigator with somebody from Amazon and somebody from Ford, I asked the question. So, you've got all this great integration here. Is there anything here that's actually unique to Ford that, that you can't do in a Stellantis vehicle or a GM vehicle that has the same capability? And they kind of hemmed and hawed and said, well, we've really worked tightly with Ford to integrate this in here, and made sure it works really well. But ultimately, the answer is no. It doesn't do anything you can't do in any other vehicle that has embedded Alexa. So, if you like using Alexa, now you can have it in new Ford vehicles.
Ta-da! And you can have a bunch of friends. It's if I don't have friends, I have Alexa. Yeah. I have Hey Ford or Hey Google or
you can have, you can have a conversation.
And then of course my smartphone.
Assistants.
You can get them to talk to each other. You make you can have full-on conversations. It seems like a win-win for everyone.
Yeah. Well, what would be nice, and a couple of years ago, 2020 CES, I was at a dinner with the Amazon team, and Ned Couric, who was then in charge of Alexa Automotive, and has since moved on to become CTO at Stellantis. Talked about this idea that they were working on what they'd ultimately like to do is not just have these things coexist with each other, but not have to require users to specify a particular wake word, but just be able to issue a command and have the system figure out, okay, which of these assistants that I'm running in parallel here can actually execute this, and then just automatically route it. That would be nice, not to have to remember which one can do what.
Yeah, because then you have to figure out like which of your three friends can do a thing. Like one friend's really good at like volleyball, like really good at math. And you're like, hey, Fred, can you help me with my math homework? You're like, oh, I meant to ask Phil. Damn it.
Yeah. All right.
That would be nice.
Someday maybe we'll get that.
Fingers crossed.
In the meantime, BMW. Has released a refresh of the X7, a mid-cycle update on the X7. What do you think of this?
The yawn was not because of the X7. The yawn was just because I'm yawning. It's an X7. It's big, three rows, giant grill. I mean, I think we talked about this beforehand, where the grill doesn't look as big as it used to, but it's an optical illusion.
Yeah, I saw the X7, the updated X7 in person on Thursday, and one of the things that the big thing that they've changed in the front is the lighting on the front. So instead of having a single slim headlamp cluster, with dual lamps in each one, and kind of the evolution of the classic, BMW four lamp, four round lamp look, They've gone to this horizontally split setup that looks very reminiscent of a certain Korean premium brand by the name of Genesis.
It looks like a kitty cat.
Yeah. So the upper slim part has the signature lighting, the daytime running lamps, and then the actual headlamps are in the lower portion. And because the combined height of these two segments, horizontal segments of lights, is taller than the single cluster that they had before, it's taking up more of the height relative to the grill. So it creates this illusion that I asked BMW, is that grill smaller than before? They said, no, it's actually slightly larger, but it looks smaller. It looks smaller than before. So overall it's better balanced than it was. Better.
Okay. So the iX, when I was in Germany, I guess it was Germany. And I was driving the car and I'm like, so about the kidney grills, they're like, and one of the designers is like, but what else would be there? And I'm like, well, that's not really an answer. I mean, a lot of things could be there. They don't have to be as big as this, though.
Well, since you don't have a frunk in there, you could actually, instead of having this long horizontal hood, you could lower it down, slope it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Go back to the look of the original 8 Series from the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Or the M1.
I think it's a mid-cycle refresh. It looks nicer. I do like the kitty cat eyes. It does look like a kitty cat, though. If you look at it, it looks like a kitty cat that's down, like ready to pounce a little bit, but not. And like that's its nose is the grill, and those are its eyes. You put some little ears on this thing, and it's a lolcat for reals.
Yeah. They also made big changes to the interior. So they went with the large curved single panel. There's still two displays in there, but the single large curved panel like you have in the iX now is the big change inside the inside the X7.
Yeah, and they have that new their updated infotainment system, which is nice. It's weird because on that i4, like, you can show apps that are part of the car, or you can show all apps, and it pulls in the apps that are also on your phone. So like Electrify America or ChargePoint, like any of the, like most of the apps that I have on my phone are also available there. And of course you click it and it goes into to CarPlay. But there's so many apps at that point that it's a little, like, it's too much. Because you don't swipe left and right, you swipe up and down. And that's, so you just go back to the regular apps, and you're like, okay, whew, okay, it's too much.
So it's automatically pulling in any CarPlay compatible apps that are on
your phone.
And it shows them on there, and then we'll launch CarPlay. Okay. I did not know that.
It's interesting. It's, you know, but you would also could just open CarPlay and open those apps as well. I think that's a much easier navigation, because the all apps thing, again, it's so overwhelming, mm-hmm. because it's all these apps and you have to scroll up and down as opposed to left and right.
Yeah.
And so it becomes it's very much something that your passenger should be doing. But if you just hit the car apps, like just the BMW apps, then it's fine. Then it just mm-hmm. has like a nice grid of, like, you know, you're not swiping up and down, because this is what's available. There's a few other things in the all apps, but for the most part, everything you need is in that area. And then, of course, you have all the little panels that you swipe left and right on with the home screen.
One thing they didn't do was add a passenger side screen to this thing. There's...
I'm not
complaining.
It's nice. No, I think it's nice that if you want to watch a movie, you can do so without holding an iPad the entire time.
Yeah.
So there's that. I mean,
rear seat passengers, you know, they still have a rear seat entertainment system.
Yeah.
You know, so they can have their own screens.
But yeah, if you're sitting in the front and you want to watch, I don't know, cartoons or a movie or some sort of Jane Austen film, you could do that in another car. Or you could just do it on your iPad.
Yeah.
Or you could just sleep.
Well, there's a thought. All right. Also at the from the New York Auto Show this week, Genesis did not have. I mean, they had a stand, but they didn't do a press conference or anything at the show. They did have a little event at their Genesis house in Chelsea, which unfortunately I was not there. But they showed off a new concept, an EV concept that they're calling the Genesis X. I don't know if it's Genesis X or Genesis 10. I'm not sure. I have to double check on the correct pronunciation of that. But the Genesis X Speedium Coupe, which is an EV luxury coupe. It's got an interesting evolution of the Genesis look, you know, transform, because you don't need that massive grill. They've kind of taken some of that shape and done it with lighting on the front, it's got big flared out fenders like a 1980s IMSA GTO car. What do you think?
It looks really. I like the idea of taking that wing, the Genesis sort of the logo, and creating this almost triangular shape in the front, so it looks a little bit like a Cylon. It looks cool. It's, you know, I think we talked a little bit about the front of the BMW, and the front, the hood of this thing is just, it's about 5-6 miles long.
Yeah.
From and then the back is a hatchback. So it's everything. It's like they were like, hey, you know, who would like this? Automotive journalist. Should we make it brown? Nah, let's not go that far.
Well, they did make it green.
They did make it green.
It's a pretty nice shade of green.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet
shade. And you never know. They might offer it in brown.
I'm sure they probably will.
If they do a production version.
I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to have to, obviously, they'll have to change to make it road legal. But not too much. I think, I'm curious how much of this is going to make its way into a production vehicle.
I would guess that... you know, based on these pictures here, it looks like it's probably about the size of a G80. You know, maybe the next generation G80 might look something like this.
It looks dope.
Yeah.
If it's, again, the whole Hyundai Motor Group.
One of the things they did at the auto show was they had the World Car of the Year awards. And Hyundai just, you know, they killed it. They got four of the six awards, went to Hyundai. Luke Dunkerwalk, their, chief creative officer, head of design, for the whole group over Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis, won Person of the Year. And then the Ioniq 5 won three awards for overall World Car of the Year, World Electric Car of the Year and Design of the Year.
I'm a World Car Juror, and I'm sure there were other people, but I nominated Luke for that. I think no, look what they're doing. Look what this person needs to be recognized. And I think, you know, it's a lot of times it's a lot of, you know, it's the CEOs, you know, they guide and they make sure that things are happening and going correctly, and they sort of, you know, they're the captain of the ship. Part of the engineering they're doing over at the Hyundai Group is great, but a lot of the allure is those designs. They're just so, so different and yet so compelling. And yeah, I was afraid that the EV6 and the IONIQ 5 were going to split the vote. Because they're almost the same car. And then it really comes down to, well, which one do you like better? Because neither car is bad. Either car you get is going to be a great experience, but which one do you prefer? And I prefer the IONIQ 5, so I was kind of happy that it won. But yeah, the Kia people should not be disappointed, because I'm sure the EV6 is probably second on that list.
Yeah, and the two awards that were not won by Hyundai Motor Group, there's three. Three awards that they didn't win. The World Urban Car went to the Toyota Yaris Cross, which is similar to the Corolla Cross we get, but smaller, same idea. So a crossover-ish variation of the Yaris. The World Performance Car went to the Audi e-tron GT, and the World Luxury Car went to the Mercedes EQS. So of all of these vehicles, winners, the only one that was not electric was that Toyota Yaris Cross, which is interesting, you know, as the World Urban Car. You would think that the Urban Car winner would probably be electric or at least hybrid, and that's the only one that was not.
Yeah, I did my column this week on LifeWire. Yeah. About how, you know, the EVs are the best cars now, except for the urban vehicle, which kind of shows, like, you know, a lot of these urban vehicles, they're small, they're inexpensive, and we don't have, like, really small inexpensive EVs outside of, like, the Mini SE that, you know, or the Mazda that they built,
the Mazda MX-30.
The MX-30, but really the Mini SE. And so it's a part of the growing EV world that, you know, we needed inexpensive, you know, EVs for people in cities where they can, you know, they don't need to be huge, they don't need a lot of range, and, you know, the Yaris Cross isn't available in the United States because people in other countries are more than happy to buy smaller cars. Well, you know, U.S. consumers are afraid that we're going to die if we're in a smaller car. I don't know. Again, with the Hummer on the road, I mean, that's a valid concern, I guess.
Yeah. No, I mean, a Hummer, you know, would probably run over something like that and not even notice it.
What was that?
Speaking of stuff that you would notice, one other stand that they had at the show was a Radwood display, which was kind of interesting. They had a bunch of 80s and 90s cars there. Radwood, for those not familiar with it, is this show that has been going, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years now. Started off in California. They do a bunch of them now around the country. I think Hagerty just recently purchased Radwood, if I recall.
Yeah, Hagerty just bought Radwood.
And so there was some really interesting cars, and there was about a dozen cars on this stand, one of which I have never before seen in person, and it was the one that first caught my attention. There was a 1991 Jaguar XJR15 back in the, I think, about 89 or 90, when Jaguar was very successful in Group C racing. TWR, Tom Walkinshaw Racing, which ran the Jaguar sports car program, built a batch of these XJR15s, which were basically Le Mans race cars. They did a one-off spec series with these things. And it looks like, yeah, there was only 28 of these ever built. And it's a really cool looking car. So they had one, a yellow one, on display there.
I can't imagine owning one of 28 of a car. That seems like too much pressure.
That's even more rare than the 250 GTO.
Yeah, I don't want that car. I was just like, you know, the cat's gonna jump on it and scratch it, or you know, what if there's a fire at my house? Or, you know, you can rebuild a house. There's only 28 of these.
Yeah.
No, it's too much. It's too much pressure. Like, whenever I get to drive a concept car, it's a little unnerving because there's like one, maybe two of these in the entire world, and they're like, "Hey, let's go for a drive," and I'm like, "Okay."
Yeah. Well, and the thing about Radwood, you know, most of the cars you see at Radwood, you know, oftentimes are, you know, kind of beaters, or, you know, they're certainly, you know, 80s and 90s models, but they're much more conventional. You know, they're not, you know, they're not these extremely rare machines. Like, you know, one of the other ones that was there, there was a 1990 Nismo Pulsar GTIR, which was the basis for Nissan's rally car of that era. There was also a Ford RS200 Evo, which the RS200 was Ford's Group B rally car that they built. Which, unfortunately, by the time it got to competition, or was ready for competition, the whole Group B category had been canceled because they determined that it was actually way too dangerous. And sitting next to the RS200 was a Citroen BX4TC, which was their Group B homologation special. And for Group B, manufacturers only had to build 200 examples of the car. You know, some of the other classic Group B cars were Lancia Delta S4, the MG Metro 6R4, which was one of the failed Group B cars. These things were just insanely fast and powerful. And most of them had...
And teeny tiny, and essentially like tin cans.
Oh, yeah. So it was pretty cool to see some of these machines there.
So was this put on by Haggerty, or was it just... Or was it just a sort of just someone with a lot of money who had a bunch of 80s cars and had...
No, it was Radwood that put on this display there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a Haggerty jam.
Yep.
All right.
So if you hear this week and you go to the New York Auto Show, if you're in the New York area and you go to the auto show, make sure you head towards the back of the hall, back to, if you're going into the hall, to the left or to the right of the Chevrolet booth, kind of behind Infinity, I think. Find this Haggerty display. It's some really cool stuff there.
You see one of 28 cars in the world. Don't touch it.
Yes.
Don't let your children near it.
Don't try to
breathe
on it.
Don't try to sit in it.
Yeah.
I have a fun, before we move on, I have a fun story. When you have the concept cars at shows, sometimes they're not like working vehicles. They're essentially just mock-ups. And I was at a show in Geneva.
Most of the time, actually.
Yeah, most of the time. I was at a show in Geneva, and there was a vehicle that... They were like, at one point they said I could get in the car to do video, and then they were like, no, you know what, never mind, you can't. And I was like, yeah, that's fine, I understand. You know, you only have one of these, it cost you $1 billion to build. I went back later to do some more shooting, and they had to put the steering wheel back on because a journalist had gotten in the car and had grabbed the steering wheel to, like, sort of prop, you know, to help pull themselves into the vehicle. They weren't supposed to be in the vehicle. They waited until security was looking the other direction, and they broke the steering wheel off.
Oh,
So the moral of that story is don't get in the cars that say don't get in the cars.
And you know, if they happen to have the car on display and you're shooting, you're photographing it or taking video of it, if they've got the doors open and you want them closed for a shot, don't try to close the doors yourself or vice versa. And if you want to get interior shots, don't try to open the doors yourself. Let somebody that knows what they're doing, because usually these things are very fragile and, you know, barely held together, and they and sometimes things work in weird ways, and you probably won't be able to figure it out on your own.
I was in the Mercedes-Benz C111, which is this car that they've built testing. That's amazing. And so it has gull-wing doors. And when they were closing it, they're like, oh, we'll close it because it's like a weird thing. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm more than happy to just sit here while you close the car. When we got back, I could open it, but closing it because the mechanism, I think they had like maybe like jiggle the handle, you know, to get to close. But yeah, so yeah, just don't touch anything.
Yeah, I have had the opportunity on a few occasions to actually drive concept cars. Back in 2007, Ford had three concepts at the Detroit Auto Show. And that summer, they did an event at their proving grounds where we actually got to drive all three of them. That was the year they had the Lincoln MKR, I don't know if you remember that one. Mm-hmm. That was the one that kind of previewed Lincoln's new design language, which has since been superseded. They had the Ford Interceptor, I think it was, a big full-size sedan, and the Airstream van concept, which was... That one was, as it was shown on the stand, it was described as having a fuel cell plug-in hybrid powertrain. But the reality is the actual vehicle had an internal a four-cylinder internal combustion engine mid-mounted in there.
Just to move it around, essentially. Yeah. Just to get so they don't have to push it.
Yeah, well, the Interceptor concept, it was a big, great big blue sedan, had a 5-liter crate motor in it. That had a carburetor, a big four-barrel carburetor on it. And when they did this event, it was in July, and it was very hot and very humid that day. And so we would take, like, one lap, and then it would have to stop and sit there for 10 minutes to cool down because it kept vapor locking, and it would stall.
Vapor locking is something I do not miss. We had my dad's 260Z would vapor lock. You'd just be driving, and all of a sudden be all,
yep. So, all right. Let's answer a couple of questions, and then I will attach the interviews at the end of the show. Start off with Adam J. He's got two questions here, or maybe it's just one. So, is there any justification for having a front-wheel drive electric vehicle? I always thought that front-wheel drive was better when the motor was up front. Because that's where all the weight was. But in an EV, that isn't necessarily the case, especially with skateboard platforms. So he's referring to here to the Toyota BZ4X. And so it says, if I get it, the EV was based on a front-wheel drive ICE vehicle, but noticed that the new... Toyota BZ4XYDYDU_J, half joking there, has a front-wheel drive option. It's a new purpose-built EV. Why would they not make the options rear-wheel drive and all-wheel drive? So the first part of this, you know, the part of the reason why, you know, we've had predominantly front-wheel drive cars over the last 30, 40 years, turning the engine sideways and driving the front wheels, you can have a more compact drivetrain. You're putting more of the weight over the drive wheels, so it can be a little more stable, get a little better traction in poor weather. And you don't have to package a drive shaft or anything down the middle. You're right. If you have an EV, you don't have to do any of that. You can put the electric motor in the back. As VW has done with their MEB platform, and a lot of other automakers are doing. Do you got any thoughts on why they would do front-wheel drive?
I think for the average person, a front-wheel drive is actually a bit more safer when it comes to driving. Rear-wheel drive, you're more likely to encounter oversteer than you are understeer in vehicles, but I don't think that's a good enough excuse. to be completely honest, I think it's because, you know, our Kona is based on a gas architecture, so it's front wheel drive, and I really do wish it was rear wheel drive, but it's fine. It's, you know, whatever, fine. But yeah, I don't I You know, I had that rear-wheel drive i4, and I did get the back end out a little bit more often than I would have, you know, if I had a front-wheel drive vehicle. So maybe that's the reason. Maybe it's just this is how we built it, and people are used to front-wheel drive. I'm going to let you in. You're the engineer.
I mean, if you, you know, an electric motor and the electric powertrain is going to weigh less than an engine. It, you know, tends to be very small, more compact than an internal combustion setup. Still, you know, if you're going to have just one motor, putting that on the front axle, you know, it is going to have more, it is going to be a little safer, a little more stable for most drivers. Like you said, you know, you're not going to have that understeer or oversteer. I mean, you know, it's whatever weight you have is being put over the steering wheels. So, you know, in poor traction conditions, it might be a little bit easier to drive, a little bit easier to steer. But since all this stuff is electronically controlled anyway, there is one other major advantage to going front wheel drive as opposed to rear wheel drive. Under braking, when you're decelerating, you're going to have weight transfer onto the front wheels. And so if you look at your car, you'll notice that your front wheel brakes are much larger than your rear wheel brakes, because under the harder you brake, the more of the braking effort that's coming from the front brakes, because you're unloading the rear axle, so you can't do as much braking force on the rear axle. And because an EV depends more on regenerative braking, if you have a rear wheel drive EV, you're not going to be able to recover as much energy from regen. And I think this is actually the main reason for doing front wheel drive.
Because the Polestar 2, the single, everyone thought it was going to be rear wheel drive, and it was front wheel drive.
Right, because you can do more regen off the front axle than you can off the rear axle. And so, you know, if you can do more regen, you can recover more energy into the battery, get a little bit more range out of it. So I think that's actually the primary reason, more so than the vehicle dynamics. The vehicle dynamics are part of it, but the ability to do more regen off the front wheels is the main reason why you would want to go front wheel drive.
Yeah,
that said, Toyota doesn't really believe in really strong regen anyway. So, yeah. You know, they could have gone rear wheel drive if they wanted to.
I just, you know, it's Toyota's. Toyota doesn't want to do this still.
Yeah, I know.
Meanwhile, Subaru's like, yeah, we got an EV. But it's like, fine. It's the same car. But whatever.
All right. The other question we got was from Car Snob.
That's a great name, by the way.
That's with two A's between the N and the B. So I'm assuming he or she are fans of no longer produced Swedish cars. Why do electric vehicles not have multi-speed transmissions?
They kind of, I mean, for the most part, they kind of don't need it. I mean, you can do the full gamut of how fast you want to go with a single gear, you know, with a single system. That said, you know, Taycan, the e-tron GT, both of those have two speed transmissions. So, you know, as you get to higher, as you're drive, the quicker you go, then it sort of goes almost into like an overdrive system. But you kind of, I still think we could probably come up with multi-speed transmissions for electric vehicles. It works well in those two vehicles, but it also adds more complexity. It adds more money, and EVs are already too expensive. Maybe in like 10 years, when the prices have gone down, someone will come up with like a really sweet, maybe it'll be Honda. Maybe a Honda will have a really sweet Civic Si with a 6-speed manual, with an electric, drivetrain or powertrain.
Well, the Jeep Wrangler Magneto that they had at, Easter Jeep Safari this year at Moab, has a 6-speed transmission.
Oh, yeah, because so it has a lower speed.
Yeah, they kept the standard 6-speed gearbox and 2-speed transfer case. I don't think it has the transfer case. I think it doesn't have the 2-speed transfer case because they don't need the torque, but just the 6-speed gearbox. You know, doing a multi-speed transmission with an EV is more problematic because you have the reason why you don't do it is because you have basically continuous torque from 0 RPM all the way up to whatever the maximum is, which is usually somewhere between 10 and 13,000 RPM. And because you have that peak torque pretty much all the way through its operating range, you know, the reason for doing multi-speed transmissions in the first place is internal combustion engines tend to have a much narrower band where they get their peak torque. You know, it might be, you know, modern turbocharged engines, you know, it can be as much as 3,000 or 4,000 RPM, but older engines, you know, it was only, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 RPM where it was near its peak. And the rest of the time you had much lower torque. And so you needed a multi-speed transmission to multiply the torque, especially to get launched, you know, to get off the line. You don't need that with an EV. And then on top of that, because that EV is making that peak torque all the time, and it doesn't, the torque production doesn't really drop off so much, you know, when you lift off the accelerator, like it does with an internal combustion engine, shifting, reliable shifting also becomes problematic. Because, you know, you actually want to reduce the torque during that shift, you know, so you're not having all that force on the gears as you're trying to engage them.
You're going to destroy second gear is what
well, and this is what happened to Tesla when they originally designed the original Roadster. It was designed for a two-speed gearbox because they needed that. They needed a lower gear to get the 0 to 60 in 4 seconds that they were targeting at the time. And then still be able to have the maximum speed that they wanted of, you know, like 120 or 130 miles an hour. But the problem is their original vendor for the, I think originally they had X-Track design the gearbox, and these things were lasting like a few hundred miles before they would just destroy themselves. And they eventually went to BorgWarner, who designed a two-speed gearbox for them. That also did not work out so well. They went to Magna, and then they went to BorgWarner. Magna tried to do a two-speed gearbox, which didn't work out. Then they went to BorgWarner, who designed just a single-speed gearbox to go with a redesigned motor that Tesla did that had a wider operating band. And they were able to achieve their original specs with just a single speed setup. But yeah, I mean, it can be really hard to do manual transmissions or multi-speed transmissions with internal or with electric motors.
When you do a retro mod and you throw in an EV into an old car, you know, if it has a manual transmission, they say, you know, just leave the transmission in there because it's too, you know, you have to do all these other modifications to the vehicle as opposed to just connecting the motor or the motor directly to the transmission. But everyone, like, you can't take off in first gear. Like, you have to take off it, like, in second or third gear.
You just put it in third gear and just drive around that way and just never touch the shifter.
Because there's so much torque that you just don't have in a regular car. If you try to take off first gear, you know, then you're just melting
all of the gears. Yeah. And if you try to take off in third gear with most internal combustion engines, you'll just stall the engine. But an electric motor won't do that. It'll just pull, no problem at all.
Yeah, maybe we'll get like 2-speed manual or 3-speed manuals, like my parents' old GMC truck, 3 whole speeds. That's it.
There are a couple of cars I have been able to launch actually in fourth gear. One was the Dodge Viper.
And, the death machine, yeah,
yeah, and the other was the C6 Corvette ZR1 with the LS9 supercharged V8 in there, and I'm sure, you know, subsequent iterations of that probably could have done that as well.
Yeah,
I remember back in the '90s when I was in England one time, I was reading one of the British car magazines, and this was in like about '93 or so. When the Viper had just come out, and they were doing a comparison test between the Viper and a Ferrari 348, and they did acceleration test from 10 to 120 miles an hour, when they did it, the Ferrari initially pulled ahead of the Viper, but then the Viper caught up and passed it and left it in the dust. The difference was the Ferrari was in first gear at 10 miles an hour and went through all 6 gears to get to 120. The Viper did the whole thing in fourth gear, from 10 to 120 miles an hour in fourth gear.
So I had a little bit less torque at the beginning, but then once it caught its band, it's poof, gone.
Yeah. So, all right. that's it for this week. Keep listening for interviews with Larry Dominique and Shelley Pratt and the Wagoneer marketing manager. And we will talk to you next week when hopefully we'll have Nicole back. But Robbie will be gone because he'll be on vacation in Hawaii.
He'll be
laying on a beach.
Or swimming. It's either one of those things. Yeah. Either laying on a beach, swimming, or eating pineapple or fish. That's it. That's the only four things I do in Hawaii. Yeah. I eat pineapple.
Those are the only things you really should be doing. You can do some hiking.
That's it. Well, yeah, but the hiking's to the beach. The hiking's to fish. Any sort of hiking is in service to one of those four things.
Yeah. All right. Talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.
The other day at the New York Auto Show, I had the chance to sit down with Larry Dominique. He is the head of Alfa Romeo North America. We talked to him a couple of months ago when the new Tonale compact crossover was first announced about what they were doing with NFTs around service records for the Tonale. This time we talked about Alfa Romeo's future plans, particularly around electrification. Recently it was announced that Alfa would be going all electric by 2027. And have a listen.
So Alfa has been making some moves recently. Obviously, you've got the Tonale here for the first time in North America. But the big news is that the brand is going to go all electric.
We are going all electric. So, you know, one of the things that Carlos Tavares recently announced in the Dare Forward 2030 plan is we would become carbon neutral by 2038 as a company globally. And as a part of that, the premium brand is actually going to lead the way. So when I see premium brands in our umbrella, we have Maserati as the global luxury brand. We're the global premium brand. And we have two other regional premium brands, DS and Lancia. Yeah. So we are going to be the leaders in moving into electrification. So we made the conscious decision that as a performance brand, there's no limitations to electrification to deliver on the alphaness and the alpha performance. So we made the decision to jump forward in that and be the first Stellantis brand globally to go full electric. Here in North America, we certainly will be. And starting in that first execution time will be 2025.
Okay.
And everything we build after that will be pure BEV. And although we'll have some new models coming after 2027, by the end of 2027, we're not going to sell ICEs anymore.
Okay. So I was talking to Nick earlier, and he mentioned that Alfa is actually apparently profitable right now.
We are.
Which, given there's been a lot of skepticism about the Alfa Romeo brand over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, everybody loves driving the Giulia and the Stelvio, including myself, and the 4C when it was still here. Never really seemed to catch on from a volume standpoint the way it was hoped when it was relaunched. What's going on with the Alfa Romeo brand now?
That's a good question. So when I came into the North American market and Gianfranco Ferrardo was assigned as the global brand CEO for Alfa Romeo, I had worked with him for 4 years at Peugeot because we were going to bring Peugeot back to the North American market. When Carlos asked Jean-Philippe to run Alfa Romeo, he went from the largest volume, highest profit brand inside the PSA portfolio to one of the smallest brands, unprofitable at the time, with Alfa Romeo. But he could bring all that experience. And when he reached out to me and asked me if I'd help him with this resurrection of the brand, so to speak. So what we did in 2021 is we both know Carlos, we've worked with him a long time. If you're going to sustain your future, if you're going to build your future, you have to be profitable. You have to fund your future as a brand. And that doesn't matter which brand you are in the Stellantis umbrella. So what we did in 2021 is we took an opportunity to look back. So what had we done since it was reintroduced in 2014? That was right. What was wrong? What do we need to fix? What hadn't we done? So when I looked initially, we had low transaction prices, low customer satisfaction, relatively low throughput at our network standpoint. So we said, we got to do some things right away. We have to take a different mindset. So the first thing I did is separated people that were in these cross-functional brand functions, and we started with a dedicated Alfa Romeo organization, both regionally and globally. So we got people that live and breathe Alfa Romeo every day and the competitive set. We also started thinking about how are we selling our cars? What's our lease penetration? We were too high in lease. Our pricing was too low. Our supply was inconsistent. So we just looked at a lot of these blocking and tackling things, which included, and probably one of the most important, is are we driving the right customer satisfaction through the transaction? Are we as a brand treating our dealers and our customers the right way? Are our dealers transacting and selling the vehicles the right way to our consumers? So 3 days into this job, I had a meeting with all the dealers, and I said, okay, guys, the world's changing. I'm not your traditional retailer guy. Trust me, I'm an engineer, I'm a product planner, I'm a quality guy, a manufacturing guy who's done everything I can up to selling the car, but I understand brands. I understand brand strength. And I said, if we don't treat customers the right way, if we don't build the right quality, and I said, it starts with us as the brand. I've got to guarantee that I'm delivering great quality out of Casino to the ports, to your dealership. But you have to guarantee to me you're treating the customers the right way, the way they expect to be treated at a premium transaction level. And what we saw through that process, Sam, is we saw not only some SSI scores go up pretty dramatically and our CSI moving, but we saw higher transaction prices. Last year, in a marketplace, a premium that went up about 15%, we went up 22%. So we raised some prices, we took lease pen down, lease support down, and the dealers, after a while, they're like, oh, I can't believe you're making all these changes, but after like 6 months, they're calling me up saying, like, I'm selling to customers I never imagined I could sell to before. This guy cross-shopped us with brand X or brand Y, and they decided to buy us. I've got my dealers. I have a new dealer here in Manhattan that said, Larry, I just got to get people in the front door. So once they see it, once they drive, man, I sell it to them. So I know we can sell the vehicles the right way. So we did all this in 2021 just to get stability. Are we where we want to be, volume and profit and satisfaction? No, but we're in the right direction. So by turning the brand profitable, we were able to lock in a future core model strategy with this financial support. So we've got five products in the core model strategy, focusing on C, D, and E segments. Can't say specifically what we're going to be building and stuff, but from a direction. So I protected the highest volume, highest profit segments in the North American market. So we're going to, as we start launching these new products with Tonali, and then we start switching to the BEV versions in 25, it's going to be 1 year after another new product.
Is that CD&E, is that just for North America, or is that your global?
That's a global core model strategy.
Okay. One of the big challenges with every legacy automaker going electric has been dealers. And especially here in North America, a reluctance by a lot of dealers to really make the push to sell electric vehicles because of the fear that they're going to lose out on service revenue, after-sales service revenue, and things like that. And, for years there's been complaints from customers going in with the intent to buy an EV, and the salesperson directing, oh, no, try this one out. You'll like this better. How have the dealers taken to this announcement of Alpha going all electric? What's been the response to that?
Yeah, so from a dealer standpoint, so right now we have 16 dealers in Canada, 134 in the U.S., and 9 in Mexico. We are to a point now where I think we're about at the right size from a standpoint of we're a very agile network. It's not this massive number of outlets and dealers and dealer partners to pivot the brand and start to think innovatively and think out of the box a little bit relative to concierge services, digital tools, electrification, whatever it might be. So we had the first ever Alfa Romeo make meeting at the NADA convention a few weeks ago in Las Vegas. And we had about 50 dealers there. It was relatively late when I called it, but we were able to get them there. And we started talking about electric car future. And the response from the dealers universally was very positive. Now, when I think about a lot of what you just talked about, Sam, if you've got a portfolio of 11 vehicles in a portfolio, and 2 are electrified and 9 are not, there's this interesting dynamic that exists in the showroom. But if you're a premium brand with a limited number of models and you're 100% EV, you don't have that showroom dynamic. And what that does, it allows the dealer to focus on training and understanding electrification to the nth degree. It allows us, from a marketing point of view, to focus on those markets and the EV messaging. But the messaging is not specifically EV. The messaging for us is Alfa Romeo. This is an Alfa Romeo. And we're designing...
Got that Alfa Romeo flair to it.
Correct. And when you look at why people buy us today, number one and number two are the way it looks and the way it performs. And I guarantee you, in electrified world, I can give looks and performance.
But it won't sound like a Giulia Quadrifoglio.
It won't sound like a Giulia Quadrifoglio, but when we start talking about what's the visceral feeling that a customer gets in the car, whether it's acceleration, deceleration, lateral Gs, whatever it might be, the sound that the vehicle makes, which we're still defining some of those metrics, we believe we can give the right kind of experience to its customers. Because once people drive electrified vehicles, they sometimes forget about the vibration from the engine because of the acceleration feel of the vehicle, the instant acceleration.
Yeah.
So, and I also feel very confident because we're drawing in some of the youngest demographic of any premium brand in the United States. Average age is about 44. We're already selling to a lot of millennials, a lot of Gen X's. So we're not trying to be a 70-year-old brand pivoting to a 45-year-old brand. We're a 44-year-old brand trying to broaden our
coverage. And that's really the core of where EV buyers are today.
It is. And we're already affluent, 150,000 plus. So, and if you look at our networks, where we are today, where we have the highest density of our networks, Southern California, Northern California, New York, New Jersey, South Florida, these are by definition going to be heavy EV markets. So we're making sure we have the right outlets, right partners in the right locations. We're going to make sure we really focus over the next 3 years till that first pure BEV hits to how we're going to market, how we're going to communicate to our customers, how we're going to train the salespeople. And on the fixed ops side, we're actually fortunate to a certain degree. We don't have a huge UIO. So we don't have dealers today on the Alfa Romeo side dedicated to a certain number of repair orders they write every day and covering their fixed ops costs. The goal for us is to make money on the front end. And then fixed ops costs will come, or fixed ops revenue will come with that volume, but the dependency on it doesn't exist today to the same degree it does in some of the bigger legacy environments.
Okay, great. That gets me to my next question. Another challenge for dealers is as they make the transition to electric, they will have to make some significant investment. And up until now, at least in North America, Alfa dealers have not necessarily sold as many vehicles as they would have hoped when they launched the brand. It sounds like they're all prepared and willing to make that investment to support EVs.
So we actually, as Stellantis, because we have electrification coming in all of our brands, we've been working with a company called Future Energy. And we're developing an electrification strategy or plan with our dealers to help them assess their needs, help them assess their infrastructure. So, and we had the fastest sign-up rate of any of the Stellantis brands for Alfa Romeo.
Oh, okay.
Now, it's also important to understand because we share 65 rooftops just dual with Maserati. We have 15 rooftops that are Alfa, Maserati, and Fiat.
Okay.
I have about 40 that are Alfa Fiat. So, when
those Maserati dealers are going to be going electric as well,
correct.
So they've got more incentive to...
Correct. And some of the most profitable stores are those dual stores.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about investment and stuff, I think they see the broader scope. Bill Pfeffer and the team over at Maserati are working really hard to move Maserati in the kind of direction that we're trying to move our brand. They're the luxury brand, we're the premium brand. So the electrification is going to be ubiquitous in the premium environment for us. So how we get the dealers thinking about it together and collectively is going to be really important.
You mentioned earlier that you started to get more conquest sales for Alfa Romeo. What brands are people coming to Alfa from?
So the good news is most of the inflows we're seeing now are other premium brands.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, it wouldn't have been the case. We saw a lot of high-end Hondas, Toyotas, move-ups. But we were at a transaction price point. I mentioned the 22% increase year over year. We were at a transaction price point where someone could either buy a high-end mainstream vehicle or they could buy an Alfa Romeo. But that's not a sustainable position for a premium brand. So with the increase in the transaction price, the dealers are learning how to market to a broader premium customer instead of down market, and that's allowed us to have a higher conquest ratio. J.D. Power has just recently showed that Alfa actually has very strong loyalty numbers. My problem is my awareness is low. So my job as the brand owner is to expand that awareness.
Okay. Anything else about what's going on with Alfa that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so there's a couple other things that we've done that I think are core to sustainable future as well. One is complexity. We've cut complexity 10x in the last year. So we had way too many variable combinations. You could get a yellow caliper with everything, a red caliper with everything. You just can't sustain that way.
Right.
From a plant quality point of view, dealer order complexity, customer shopping complexity. So we've been very, very strategic in our sprint, TI, Veloce, and Quadrifoglio planning. We've been able to push the mix up. So we're selling a lot more TIs and Veloces. Veloce is now our volume model for both Stelvio and Giulia. And I expect it will be as well for Tonali. So we're being really smart on the complexity side. On the supply side, we've done two things. One, we're working with Europe to have a much more steady supply coming from Europe. No fits and starts. I don't want this kind of inventory adjustment. I want it to be like this. more boats coming to the U.S., getting more cars on all the boats coming over. At the same time, we've gotten to work with our dealers. We had an uneven distribution of inventory. We had dealers that were struggling to earn inventory because they weren't selling cars. It's kind of a self-fulfilling chicken-egg thing. So we helped those guys get cars by getting some of our dealers with volume to sell some vehicles to them, and we guaranteed an allocation backfill for those cars. So we're spreading out the inventory, getting our sales to try to spread out more evenly. And we did a special allocation just a couple months ago for the end of the 22 model year. That's going to put even more inventory into these historically slower markets to see if we can stimulate those guys to get re-engaged. And I'm pretty pleased with the progress so far.
So you got a green car in your lot. It's not I got a customer once and bought a green car. So they've been looking forever. And you don't want to give it up because you're afraid you're going to lose your deal for it. And I get a premium for the car because it's exactly what that person wants.
Yeah.
So he's figured a way to make that work.
That's great. And then Tenali is coming early next year, early 2023.
Yeah, so production will start Q4. You know, European production just started. I think they deliver the first vehicle in June. Q4 for us. So we'll start with the 2-liter GME, and then the PHEV will follow shortly thereafter.
And the other piece you said, so is the quality component. JPI's visiting plants now, you know.
Yeah, as I mentioned to the dealers, you know, quality starts with us. And Jean-Philippe literally visits Casino, now Pomigliano, every single month with Richard Schwarzwald, who runs global quality for Stellantis. They do a quality review, 3-month in service reviews, supplier quality reviews. He is pushing, and our 3-miss numbers just keep dropping, right? So I'm really happy. The numbers coming out of Casino right now, and I don't have anything coming from Pomigliano yet, but the numbers coming out of Casino are world class from a quality point of view. So I'm starting to see it at the dealership level. Yeah. Customers are very satisfied.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Larry. Always good to talk to you.
Good to see you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.